Down south, they say it's the economy, stupid. Up here, we say it's the economy, eh? And this is Political Economy Radio, a progressive take on economic issues in Canada and beyond. My name is Michał Rozwodski, and welcome to the show. This weekend, we'll witness a convergence of worldwide activism around the issue of climate change, centered, as it so often happens, on New York City, where hundreds of thousands are expected for the People's Climate March on Sunday. To unpack all of this, my guest today is Arun Gupta, author and journalist. He's a founding co-editor of The Independent Magazine and The Occupied Wall Street Journal. He is part of a forthcoming media project called the Dissent News Network, and is a regular contributor to The Guardian, Al Jazeera America, and other outlets. I reached him in New York. So, Arun, this weekend marks the climate convergence and the People's Climate March in New York City. But before that, on Saturday, as part of the convergence, you're speaking on a panel that's evocatively titled Apocalypse How, Climate Change, the Political Economy of Energy, and Reigniting the Radical Imagination. And one of the issues I gather that this panel discussed is something you and others have labeled catastrophism. And perhaps you could just start by explaining this term.
Yeah, you know, catastrophism is just simply end of the world ideology, and it's as old as human history, right? You know, from the first flood mythos. But it beyond religion, it's very prevalent in political circles on the left, right, and center. It's there are all sorts of varieties of it. What we are going to be talking about it in the context of is climate change and this notion that human civilization is coming to an end, or that humanity itself is doomed. This has become a very kind of prevalent, almost hegemonic idea on the left and in many environmental circles. And so what we want to do is argue against it, that this is highly problematic in a lot of ways. And the way that catastrophism, certainly not everyone is using it this way. You know, I think I just saw Naomi Klein tonight speak in New York City on the launch of her new book, This Changes Everything. She's arguing that the crisis is so severe that, you know, it's going to really fundamentally change human society. And I think there is a certain truth to that, that when we look at the predictions of what is going to happen to the natural world, the disruptions that have occurred and will continue to occur and intensify are going to fundamentally reorder human society. The difference I think I have, not so much with her, you know, because she's a very sophisticated and nuanced thinker, the difference I have with a lot of other people is they think that catastrophe is going to usher in the utopian society. And it has a very kind of religious apocalyptic sensibility to it, right? This is very Christian, that, you know, there's going to be the Armageddon, the end of the world, and there are all sorts of variations on it, essentially, but then we'll have the kingdom of God afterward. And so it's the catastrophe is going to usher in the utopia. And this is very dangerous thinking. And the panelists I'm speaking at, we're going to break down different components of this. We're going to look at political economy. We're going to look at the political uses of catastrophe. I'm going to deal kind of with more the social cultural aspects of it, because I think, you know, we already live in a post-apocalyptic society. Hollywood is completely post-apocalyptic. You can't go to the movies without, you know, being hit in the face with one form of apocalypse or another. And then we'll also have Francis Fox Piven, who will be talking about the history of social movements, because we want to make clear, like, look, you know, telling people that there's going to be this cataclysm, you know, that is that could wipe out humanity, this is the politics of fear. And trying to organize around the politics of fear is never going to be successful on the left, right? You know, we want egalitarianism, we want equality, we want a society free of fear. organizing around fear is inherent to right-wing politics. So by using fear and the catastrophe and apocalypse as kind of your organizing principle, I think is very dangerous, because it actually benefits the right, and it actually benefits the capital, because one, you know, you can then easily convince people there's going to be a catastrophe. Well, we just need to, you know, let everyone else die. We need to create these gated communities. Or, you know, the capitalists will come along and are ready to say, and they're already doing this, right, with, you know, they're salivating at the notion that the Arctic Ocean is opening up for drilling, for shipping routes, for mineral extraction. They'll come along and say, like, hey, we've got all the solutions. It's not really a catastrophe. And frankly, when you tell the public, you know, that there's going to be a catastrophe versus the capitalists are saying, no, there's a technological cornucopia that awaits you. What do you think the public's going to choose? They're going to go with the state and capitalism.
And I think that's one of the issues, that's one of the aspects of it that's quite interesting, is that this is at heart a sort of disabling vision as well. I mean, you talked about it as a sort of salvation, but it also, you know, allows people to say, well, I can just sit back yes. And, you know, this will happen. So what then are some of the economic phenomena, things from political economy, that lend themselves to this kind of catastrophic thinking, you know, peak oil or things like this?
Yeah, that I think gets to the heart of the matter, is that catastrophism is actually really poor political economy. You can't even call it political economy. It just, the ideas are a muddle. It's a notion that there are fixed limits to thing, that nature is something apart from humanity, and we exist in entirely two separate spheres, and that we just have access to what the natural world has offered us. Rather, in reality, especially under capitalism, we produce resources. And the easiest way to understand this is fracking and tar sands. These are not traditional forms of petroleum, of crude oil and of natural gas, that we have to use cutting-edge technology to be able to bring these hydrocarbons to the surface. You know, the tar sands they're buried under, I guess, something like 20 or 30 meters of soil and sand in one of the most inhospitable and beautiful and pristine regions in the world. The industry is expending huge amount of resources to bring all this bitumen, essentially solid form of oil, up to the surface, and then to process it and turn it into crude oil. Similarly, the fracking industry is using these advanced methods to drill down and then horizontally miles, and use chemicals and high pressure and the slurry to fracture these shale formations that sometimes go 1 to 2 miles down to release the natural gas that has been trapped in there. Capitalism creates these resources that then brings them to market. So talking about things like peak oil fundamentally misunderstands the nature of capitalism. And the fact of the matter is, you can go back and look at what is called the reserve to production ratio. Over time, the amount of proven reserves, and to call something proven reserves, it has to be very extremely high probability that you can bring it to market. Over time, since the 1950s, the ratio of proven reserves to annual production has remained remarkably consistent at about, I think it's 42 years. So even though the global economy has grown so many times, even though, you know, like, who knows, 10 or 20 times, even though our consumption of hydrocarbons has also grown enormously since the 1950s, we still basically have the same amount of energy at our fingertips that can be bought to market. And the fact of the matter is, you know, as a Saudi oil minister, Saudi Arabian oil minister, says, the Stone Age didn't end because we ran out of stones. The oil age is not going to end because we run out of oil. It has to be a conscious decision. It has to be social actions that shift us away from the hydrocarbon economy and, more importantly, from capitalism. Of course, all of this has consequences. All of this is socially lived, and that's what we need to understand about, yes, there is catastrophe, but there's a very uneven social geography on which this catastrophe plays out. And geography is the way to understand it, both literally and metaphorically, because that geography is about wealth. It's about power. If you have more wealth, you have a bigger base. And so just like people who live in floodplains, who live in deltas, countries like Bangladesh or a lot of the South Pacific Islands, they're going to be devastated by climate change, even though they didn't have to have anything to do with it. Countries like the U.S. and Canada are going to be relatively insulated. So capitalism will always try to figure out a way to profit off the crisis. And the dislocations may be hideous, but they're going to be unevenly felt. And some people may profit very handsomely and come out even better off than they were before.
I think that actually ties in quite well to, of course, the new Naomi Klein book that's been making a lot of noise. This changes everything. But it's really the subtitle, Capitalism versus the Climate, that really puts it in these terms that you're just speaking about right now. In fact, I just saw an interview with Naomi Klein in the paper you co-founded, The Independent. And she explained there and in other places that she's far more ready to sort of endorse large-scale, state-led, these kind of socializing actions rather than rely on a kind of naive localism or smaller, smaller solutions that are far more decentralized. What's your reaction to this, especially in light of this weekend? Is this sort of symptomatic of something broader that's changing within the climate movement? Or is this just, or is she more trying to push something that's not yet there?
I think that's a great question, because I think it's part of a broader social shift. And I think during the 90s, especially post-Cold War, where a lot of people came of age politically, it created certain illusions. The Hart and Negri idea that empire was decentered and, that it was everywhere. And, when September 11th was the, explosive rejoinder to that. There is a very much a center to empire. There's a, the capitalist. It's not capitalism versus the state, it's the capitalist state. And there's some seminal work in terms of like Karl Polanyi, The Great Transformation. We can talk about the intertwining of these two entities. His famous formulation, laissez-faire was planned, by that meaning that you don't have a free market without the state regulation of land, labor, and finance. And to that we can add ecology. So the state has always been very central. I think during the 90s, there was an illusion that the state had kind of dissipated. And I think post September 11th, people started to wake up to that more. But I think it's really kind of the post the economic crisis, the bust that started in 2007 and continues. I think what Paul Krugman accurately calls the lesser depression. This is not a recession, it's a depression. The state intervention has been incredibly important, and we can see how important the state is to managing this crisis. And there's no way around it. We're not going to have like these coordinating cooperative bodies that are going to be able to undertake the type of dramatic shifts that we need in policy, in terms of legislation, in terms of reorienting society, social resources, i.e. investments, towards decarbonizing and building a renewable energy system and a sustainable economy. I don't place my hope in the state. I think we have to have a very much more sophisticated view, and we have to struggle mightily, fiercely over it. And but I think you can't just throw the state out the window either.
Right. And now we could turn to the role of this struggle of large scale sort of activism. I know you've been critical of some of the aspects of this whole undertaking this weekend around the convergence and the climate march. And maybe before we get into why you think it's important to be there regardless, maybe you can say a few words about your reservations first.
So I think, you know, I'm going to be at this march, and I think what's more important is the Flood Wall Street action on Monday, where people are looking to shut it down. Now, I've talked to over a dozen organizers, including paid staff from the main organizing groups, and what I've been told paints a troubling picture. As one person told me that there was a push very early on in the spring of 2014 to people wanted to see more of a Seattle-style action. They wanted to see a mass direct action actually trying to shut down the streets around the United Nations. But they were consistently stymied by organizers, and that kept being put off again. And it all became about this march. And this march, it's on a Sunday. The UN, the world leaders aren't even getting there for 2 days later. So they're not even in town. The meeting isn't for 2 days later. They're not even in town. The march isn't even, it's coming, the closest it comes to the United Nations is about a mile away. There are no demands. They let the police determine the route. They let the police tell them you can't have any rally or speakers at the end. So this march was deliberately neutered by basically liberal NGOs of any politics. And what they've done is they've turned it into a giant marketing campaign. I worked on Madison Avenue for close to 10 years, and I can smell an advertising, a marketing campaign a mile away. And that's what this really is. It's about trying to get people excited about a product, and they've essentially turned social justice into a product, in this case climate change. And what they're really trying to, and they send out all these emails, like, you know, when you see go into a supermarket, everything is, it's like it's the zestiest, it's the tastiest, it's the most amazing ever. And that's what these emails are like. They're like, the future is on the line and history is at stake and we're going to, you know, change everything. And yet one of the senior people I talked to said, like, yeah, we don't think any, you know, this is going to amount to much. And basically what the hope is that this opens some space for politicians to take more of a stand. In other words, they're trying to appeal to the Democratic Party. I have an article that just went up on Counterpunch that details all of this, so your listeners can look at that.
But you're nevertheless participating both in the march and the forum on this panel and other things, and I know you've been encouraging others to participate. Why is this event nevertheless important for building climate politics, and how are you sort of approaching it critically?
Well, the future is unknowable. I mean, nobody knew what was going to happen on November 29th, 1999. You know, nobody knew how the political social terrain would have shifted just a few days later after the shutdown of the World Trade Organization in Seattle, just a dramatic rupture that created, right? Nobody knew on, you know, September 10th how it would shift again. And nobody knew on September 17th, 2011, you know, what was in the works when a few score scruffy individuals put down cardboard and sleeping bags in Zuccotti Park in Lower Manhattan. You know, we don't know what the result of our actions are going to be. So it is very important to act. And, you know, even if I'm critical of something, I think it's better to first see, like, can I support it? And, you know, I think your criticism it becomes a lot more serious if you show that you're in solidarity with it. You know, we just don't want to be, like, you know, on the sidelines spitting in the tent. I think it's important to recognize that this is mobilizing a lot of people, that there are a lot of people who do feel that this is, you know, one of the most vital, maybe the most vital issue humanity is facing. I think it's more complicated than that. I wouldn't reduce humanity's problems to just one issue. You can't also reduce the ecological crisis to just one issue. There are many ecological crises that are intertwined. Nonetheless, you know, you need to struggle with people. And if you have criticisms, you need to do it side by side, not yelling at them from the comfort of your internet connection and your Twitter account.
So to wrap up, maybe say a couple words about where this leaves us moving forward.
We can complain about this. You know, I'm just describing it so people can understand. I don't think the point is to complain. The point is to get organized, right? It's been 3 years since the Occupy Wall Street movement. I don't think there's any excuse for the fact that all those people, all those great organizers who are part of it, were not able to create some good national organization out of that, or at least regional organizations, right? We should have some good movements, because some good radical movement organizations that came out of that. The alternative is what's going on now. When the radical left, when the anarchists don't get their act together and deal with issues of organization, of structure, of leadership, of strategy, and even hierarchy, okay, there's no way to have an organization, a mass organization, without having some sort of hierarchy. That hierarchy should be transparent, it should be accountable, but you still need some sort of hierarchy to be able to strategize for a mass movement. You can't get 5 million people around a general assembly. So this is a failure of the radical left, is what I'm trying to say, that the liberals are going to come into the vacuum and co-opt it. And this has happened time and time again. So don't complain about it. Get organized. Out-organize them.
All right. Thanks a lot, Arun.
Okay.
That was Arun Gupta, author and journalist. I'll be back in 2 weeks. Until then.